because of some degree of limitation of design that doesn't qualify them as a microprocessor itself. But these things have been in equipment for more than 30 years. Again, you know more than I do. I have one sitting, and I have something called a CW machine that's sold by Begali, and it has a PIC chip that runs it all, and it's a great little device. So these are fascinating devices that continue on decade after decade after decade. You get an idea when someone came up with something that's truly very useful, that they keep producing them.
Here's my take, microcontroller versus microprocessor. A microprocessor is basically the CPU. A microcontroller uses a much smaller CPU but adds the peripherals on chip. Have your master clock that runs everything on chip. You have your program and your scratch pad on chip. You have peripherals like ADD converters, timers, carriers on chip. And I've been amazed how much stuff I can do. I just gave you just one example. I can give you others, but I'm not sure I want to bore you with this going on and rambling. Oh, one other thing for Andy. If Andy is still listening, I want to know how many milliamps the push-to-talk line for the radio sends to ground. My fear is you might have been overstressing the PIC chip when you turn on the transmitter. They're rated for about 8-10 milliamps sent to ground. I'd have to look that up. But it's possible that that might be what failed. Back to Roy, WB3AB.
Okay, very good. Andy, if you're out there, respond.
Yeah, I'm still listening, yeah. I have to look up the specs. I don't know how much it sinks to ground, but it wouldn't be much current, yeah. But I don't think this PIC, along with this box that was built, has been working continuously since 1988 without any problems whatsoever. Any faults, with it's been dropped, it's been crashed, it's been moved, it's been bounced, it's been through the mill. I repackaged it so you can take the abuse, but never have I had a circuit problem before, so I don't think that all of a sudden this is what the case is, that it's drawing too much current to the PTT line on the radio is causing that. That's my opinion. Never had a problem before. Back to you.
Understand fully, Andy, but I'm clutching at straws here. And it's not totally out of question. I have had stuff that is overstressed, and it doesn't blow out instantly, but eventually it does. Here's all you have to do is just use a DC milliammeter to ground the push-to-talk line. What it is, and you look it up, I could look it up and find out because pretty much all these microcontrollers have the same on the I/O ports, they have the same output stage, and you can tell how many milliamps to sync and stuff like that. In all cases, a milliammeter, you see how much it takes, and then look it up and see where it stands on that.
I understand that, yeah. Okay, I got what you're saying. I didn't think of it because I don't think that's an issue, but I can check it and see how much current is actually sinking. It's a Radio Shack HTX202, which is a portable 5-watt handheld radio, which I have a few of them, by the way. I don't think that changed. I could key that up manually if I ground the push-to-talk line. I made the interface for the radio, by the way. I made the modification to the radio. So I take raw discriminator audio right out of the radio. I bypass the amplifier. The volume control has no effect on the signal, the audio that comes out. which will go into the touchstone decoder. So that's not affected at all by any knobs or any adjustments. So I'm going through a little filter also, which I manufactured. Okay. All right. I was still listening, but I, quarter after 10, I'm just doing some on the computer here. I looked up that PL-866, and that's an interesting program there. I'm curious about that. But I want to get the data sheet on the PIC controller itself. I got to look that up, and then I'll print it out. Do that. As Jeff said before, AC2PL, he mentioned that, so that'll be a good thing to see if there is a problem. Then maybe, hopefully not to start from scratch, maybe, hopefully it's the decoder, it'll be a lot easier. All right, thanks. I'm gonna go now. I'm going to actually turn the radio off because I'm going to finish up another job. Thanks a lot, guys. WHCDL. Back to you, Roy, and 73.
Hold on. 5 seconds. One, just get a milliammeter, get a reading, let me know. Two, that data sheet, by 300 pages, careful what you're looking for. You might get it. All right, now over to Roy.
I got that.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks, Ed, for your expertise. I know you've done a lot of work with PIC chips. Again, I've only kind of had one device with a PIC chip in it. I've been doodling around with Raspberry Pis here at the chat. So I thank you, Ed, and Andy, again, wish you luck, and I am pretty willing to bet money that you'll come up with some kind of solution for this.
And I think I can reprogram one for jump stretch.
Sounds like a plan.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. WHCDL.
You're welcome, Andy. Anyone out there with either any comments about what we've been discussing, or if anyone has any kind of comments or questions for a couple of minutes, just hit that push to talk button and say your piece.
Quick general comment, AC2PL.
Certainly, Jeff.
Hey, good evening, Roy. Just an observation that we as programmers of various levels of skill tend to fill up the available memory, and I'm not sure how advisable that is. And we started at nibbles and bits and bytes, and now I'm downloading programs that are genuinely massive in the gigabytes range, and it's insane how programming has become less and less efficient as the availability of memory has come online. Just an observation, AC2PL.
Here's my comment.
Programmers
are described to you, Roy, is about 214-bit words.
Okay, very good. I mean, the problem is that I probably was unaware with very early computers. My appreciation began with the 4004 micro sort of CPU and the Altair that was the 8008 and others. You know, we're a single kilobyte of available memory was a great thing to behold. My first radio was an Atari 800. It was able to hold a whopping 48,000 bytes of information, I believe. And we have, as Jeff mentioned, been terribly spoiled. You know, nowadays it's nothing to get a software patch that's a gigabyte of data. I mean, compilers are very inefficient these days. In the very old days, guys would handle it in machine language, assembly language, which is very close to machine language, and then interpreters and compilers started to get used, and they're not very efficient, and they're not designed to be terribly efficient, because we'll just throw a couple extra megabytes at it. So yeah, it's rather unfortunate that craftsmanship is kind of on a decline. You kind of throw stuff into some compiler that Microsoft is producing, and you get this kind of bulbous return. It works, but it loads It's big and it has a lot of nonsense embedded in it. So I agree with you, Jeff. Those days are far behind us. People will use and abuse the amount of memory capacity that they have available, especially if it takes a little bit extra work to clean stuff up.
As an iconoclast, I have to take exception. I am using memory.
Well, good for you. There are people out there who still use assembly, but they are not as usual as they once were. Even in the days of, because there were interpreted language and compiled languages, but people took the time to pull out little time-sensitive modules and code it in machine language or assembly and plug it in. I think those days are few and far between, but I like to see that you do it the old-fashioned way, which I think is the best way.
So, as I said, the timing is critical. This doesn't work if I let some compiler decide how long it takes to run a particular part of the program. I have to know. It's critically important.
Yes, I understand. For your applications, you need that critical timing that's not usually required in a personal computer software type of environment. I'm glad that the craftsmanship of programming continues despite third-rate software languages. It seems like every week and a half, someone invents a new software language. I've lost track. I counted hundreds and hundreds before I stopped counting them. But, you know, if you go to sleep tonight, you get up tomorrow morning, and if you kind of do a thorough search, someone has described a new compiler or a new interpretive language.
Hey, Roy, I have an interesting human story on that subject.
Certainly. I'd love to hear it.
WB3AD. I've been using the microchip microcontrollers on and off since the mid-90s. But after a several year gap, I had some ideas about 2 years ago, which were related to the thing I just described to you. Hang on, let me just put a drop for a second. All right, I'm back. And I had nothing in the way of the development, hardware, or anything. So I started looking into the dealer with microchip technology, and they made a big deal. Oh, yeah, we still do assembly language. We're really pushing C, but we support assembler, and we're coming out with a new assembler language programming system. I said, oh, boy, oh, boy. And then they come out with it, and I put it on my set, and nothing has worked. Now, the one thing is their new development system that goes on my home computer. I realized, not that they told me, not that there's anything in it, I'm just playing with the, you know, the buttons and the stuff that they put on there, you know, graphical user interfaces and stuff like that. And I discover I can actually look at what's in different parts. I can look at the program memory. I can look at the scratch pad memory. I can look at the non-volatile scratch pad. And I program the chip, nothing happens. And just for fun, I play with this. And I go to the program memory. There's nothing there. Wait a minute, it said it was loaded. I go to the scratch pad memory. Yeah, that's about what I expect. Then I go to the non-volatile RAM storage memory. That's where I put my program. I will continue, but any comments?
No, don't need to comment.
So by this point I found out the best way to communicate, actually the only way to communicate them is by email. Typically, you know, I pull my heart out to an email, send it to them, and about typically the next day I'll get a reasonable response. so I send it to them. The whole thing is put in a scratch pad memory. You know, a non-volatile scratch pad. And days later, I get back to the response saying, you realize a supercompiler allows you to do stuff or copy stuff in assembler. Here's a representative program. You can use the supercompiler. And I looked at it and I realized, you know, the old joke about, you know, to do something you have to rub your belly and scratch your head. And that's what I'm doing. I'm rubbing my belly and scratching my head, put my assembly program into the C-compiler format. But then I realized, you know, it's just a little annoying. That's what I have to do. That's what I have to do. And ever since then, it's been wonderful.
So you had to translate it? What was going on with the assembler?
No. I can use assembly language. What I have to do is put a couple of lines verbatim that they gave me at the top of the program, and a couple of lines they gave me verbatim at the bottom of the program, and every line has to start and end with certain punctuation marks, as you would normally do with a C program. But the code itself is assembly. And what I actually do is I stored it in a Excel file on my computer where I have all the C-related crap in spots and the assembly language stuff in spots. Follow that?
Yep.
So instead of, like, you know, rubbing your belly and scratching your head while you do something.
Okay, I mean, to me that's kind of a shame, unless it's very, very well documented and, you know, on the top of any kind of material that they offer for people to figure out how to do the work. I mean, you know, assembler is assembler. Assembler doesn't have aspects of C or C++ or what have you. So it seems to be a kind of a proprietary version of assembler on their part.
There are two possibilities. One is if I went back and tried the same thing again, it might work now, but I'm afraid it took me a while to get this working, and Joe Baddage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'd rather rub my belly and scratch my head than risk screwing the whole thing up. There's also a possibility it would work exactly the same, but maybe you are right. Maybe I am the true solo iconoclast, Don Quixote, Toby and Window. I may be the only one doing this.
I don't know. I hope that there are other people tilting at those windmills. I would hate to think that there's only one that remains. I could almost sense guys who worked in assembler. They were kind of different than guys who worked in compiler or certainly interpreter language. Their minds worked in curious different ways than mine.
Well, I agree with that because I find this stuff just suits my personality. I find the way the chips work with my personality, the simple-minded way they program suits my personality.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was very into Amiga computers. And that was kind of my first club long before amateur radio. And I got to meet some of the guys that did the software and the hardware engineering for the Amiga. And these were heavy-duty assembly guys. You kind of sense it just talking to them, or attempting to talk to them.
Attempting but failing?
Well, you know, some of those guys operated at a slightly different frequency, I'm afraid to say.
That can happen in any endeavor.
Well, that's true. But sometimes people with a really gift for a very, very narrow-based thing, like assembly or other things, Sometimes operate on some kind of slightly different frequency. Hopefully you can, just because some people know a lot, but they can't teach. And I think that's the reason why. The truly gifted individuals are the guys that can understand it and translate it for us mere mortals.
My brother, who you were recently with, and I invented a term for this.
Which is?
Constructive timidity. In other words, don't be shy. If you have to dumb it down to your audience, go for it. Do what you have to do to be understood.
I guess so, but in every case, people kind of decide on where to put the line and not cross that line. And different people put it in different places. I've mentioned, unfortunately, too many times that Stephen Hawking had a very popular book in which he mentioned Hawking radiation, and his description was simple down to the point that physicists were really annoyed with people who thought they understood the principles involved. So I understand that if he describes quantum gravity to most people who read popular books, will get a headache, and so he wanted his sales to be strong, and so he kind of fudged things. Sometimes it makes a lot of sense to soften the edges, but if you soften them too much and they turn into a fairy tale, all that kind of leaves you, in my humble opinion, is the false sense that you understand the concept a little more. So it's a problem that people who explain technology to other people tend to have to deal with.
Then I am 200 years in the netherworld of babies. I have done things like tell a 10-year-old fish to understand what a vinyl LP is. I said it's basically a speech.
Okay, I mean, there are very fascinating YouTubes where a specialist in the field is given three people. One is a 10-year-old. One is a person who has an adult who has no particular scientific experience, and the third person is a PhD in a different field but vaguely similar, and they videotape how the professional adjusts the discussion accordingly to the individual it's being presented to. And that's also a very fascinating series of YouTube.
I just love to oversimplify stuff so that it's one does get across.
Okay, but again, sometimes, unfortunately, it leaves these little landmines where, I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you'll kind of dumb it down to a guy because he just wouldn't get it, and then you overhear him sharing that simplified information with other people who could probably deal with a somewhat more complicated, more accurate assessment. And, you know, what do you do? You kind of let the whatever out of the bag.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't think that ever has happened to me specifically. It always happens all the time. Trying to tell people that do not have the proper understanding and talking to the wall.
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I have in my past come across people where I have tried different methods of getting ideas across, and for whatever reason, their failure, my failure, it doesn't work. So you just kind of, you deal with it. I remember this one guy came in to a club meeting, and his machine was broken. And I said, well, how is it broken? Can you explain it? Can you describe it to me? He says, it doesn't work. I said, yes, I realize it doesn't work, but in what way does it not work? It doesn't, they're not. I said, does the display light up? Is there any kind of indication? Couldn't get anything more than it's broken, it doesn't work. So I wished him good luck, and in afterthought, the guy was just looking for an excuse to spend money on a new radio. So I don't think he was really that motivated to figure out what had gone wrong.
What's wrong with saying, you know what? I really don't care. I've decided it's time to replace it anyway.
Well, unfortunately, most people are not that kind of upfront, at least in my experience. They tend to kind of cover it in a thin veneer of requirement. And because this unfortunate gentleman couldn't afford the new radio, and he basically had a relative buy it for him as a present, I guess that served a good purpose, him not mentioning that he really didn't want to get it fixed anyway.
Easy to build.
Yes, Jeff.
Was the, did you get a chance to work on this, and when you finally got it running, was the frequency set to 27 megahertz?
What are you alluding to?
I'm alluding to the fact that probably 90% of the busted radios that came into my shack were set to, how shall we say, something other than ham bands when I finally got them going.
Oh, I don't even know if this guy was capable of it. Very unfortunate gentleman. At one point, he was having problems with a push-to-talk control and on a net, and we asked him if he had considered using that box control on his radio that we all knew he had, and unfortunately his response was, "What's that?"
Yeah, you get that too. Most of the guys that sent me these radios are very knowledgeable. They're both hams and other users, let's just call them that. But the amount of power that they put out from a variety of sources tends to get back into the other radios and blows them up.
Ah, yes, those fellows. I once had an interesting experience. I do a 10-meter net every Sunday morning on 28.380 upper sideband, 11 o'clock. And there was a time that all of a sudden I was hearing a CB-er. Which was odd, because you're 10 meters, you're supposed to be at 11 meters. And sure enough, I opened up my little pan adapter to the CB band, and there he was on 11 meters. But he had such a filthy linear amplifier that it was running so many harmonics all over the place that he was interrupting my net on a different band entirely. I don't think he cared, because we tried to make him aware the fact that he was doing a lot of harmonics, and he continued on for at least 6 months. So, yeah, I know those guys.
Yeah, one day we should discuss how 11 meters ends up on 10 meters, but because it's not an even harmonic or anything like that, but the spillover is definitely manifest and obvious. Anyway, not to pick on those guys, because a lot of them are very knowledgeable. The only thing that the only real complaint that I have, who are the guys that are hams and like to operate on other bands, is that the antennas are sitting there looking at each other and absorbing the radiation and transmitting it back down. And I've seen a lot of fried inputs, and they just don't understand what happened, and they come up with some other explanation that they give to me. And of course, you know, you do all of the preliminary testing and identify the problem. And oftentimes it's not what their imagination came up with.
Yes, a lot of people don't tend to take responsibility or kind of change reality to suit their purpose. It's part of human nature.
Enjoy.
Yes, Ed.
You know, Jeff brought up that thing. I was talking about it. From 11 meters to 10 meters is not on mine. But that's how I meant to think about it. I assume that sometimes there's a mix that generates the sideband signals that will look up. Maybe a mixing. There's always an image and it's not being rejected. I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I assume it's some kind of intermod distortion occurring at the point of the nonlinear amplifier. Not that it's actively generating harmonics of the 11-meter transmission, but that box is just spewing all kinds of erratic frequencies that are having intermod mixing and such.
I changed the subject a bit to a case where I decided to I had a problem, and I literally did not want to troubleshoot it at all.
Well, yeah, I'd love to hear it as it's 10:36. I'm already feeling guilt-ridden about delaying Paul's SpaceNet report. He has, I know, at least one really important story about, unfortunately, Artemis delay and such. So can we save it for next week?
I have 10 seconds.
Certainly, you have 10 seconds.
I was doing some final absolution to before scrapping a car that we decided wasn't worth fixing when it broke down. I just bothered to troubleshoot it.
Okay, I could understand that. You know, sometimes you just want to move on.
Yeah, why fix this so it's junk it?
Yeah, I've sort of been there. I was in a minor car accident where the rear was kind of smashed in, and it was kind of an old car, so I just kind of slowly moved it towards a dealership and just got another car.
Yeah, in this case, I didn't know what the problem was, and something is just peeking at me. You should know. No, I don't.
Well, you know, sometimes you want the challenge, sometimes you don't want the challenge. That's the beauty of having a couple of bucks saved up.
All right, I've done enough damage. WB3AD is going back into the background.
Okay, very good. This is AC2GS, and I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and Please come back next Sunday when we'll try and do it all over again. But now, my apologies to Paul WS2N, but now it's time for the SpaceNet report.
Hey, C2GS, WS2N. Very good, boy. And I've listened to you guys talk about technical topics. I mean, that's how I learned everything, through ham radio, all these technical electronics and all. I mean, I knew the basics years ago, but you get on these tech nets and you really wind up with a load of knowledge. And it's really helpful. And we used to do this, right? I mean, we used to go to 12 o'clock at night. Dick would get on a topic and keep it going. And actually, beyond that, they put a limit on the repeater. It used to go 1 o'clock until 2 o'clock, you know. And, let me drop it. I'll just go through a couple of these, like you said, a couple of important topics. And by the way, I buy almost new cars, and then I keep them forever. Practically run them to the ground, and I'm a good mechanic that way, fixing, you know, keeping them up. Nowadays, of course, that's not that easy. The space launch system Artemis, of course, did not get off the ground last Monday. It was scheduled to go up, and it wound up with a leak in the number 3 RS-25 engine. That's one of the 4 liquid fuel engines, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, that's located on the bottom of the fuel tank. Right above those engines, you have the hydrogen tank, and then which holds roughly twice the amount of liquid as the oxygen tank, the liquid oxygen tank. You know, and then, you know, you see the exhaust when this thing will go up. It's very similar to the space shuttle. It's really just going to be vapor, water vapor. So you got H2O, twice the amount of hydrogen to oxygen. And unfortunately, the process for hydrogen, you've got to bring the temperature down to roughly 420 degrees. That's their goal. They've got to pre-chill them before they light things off. get something so cold, if you have ambient temperature, you know, you probably crack something and do some damage. So they couldn't get number three down to the proper temperature. After going through evaluations, you know, the next day, they realized that it's a sensor. The sensor is false, giving them a false reading. And they were off by about 20 or 30 degrees where the other ones were at proper temperature. So they said if they could have confirmed that, they would have launched or tried to launch that Monday. So now time goes by. They have a path to launch on Saturday. So here it is, 2:17 p.m. Saturday. They're going to try it again. And they knew right away in the beginning when they started filling up the hydrogen, they wound up with another detector saying that on the fill line, there was a leak in the cavity area. That means the connection, 8-inch connection, the 8-inch diameter, like pipe, it's got a bulldoze point to it, and then, you know, this forces its way into, you know, into that position. There's no bolts or flanges or anything. It's a force type of fit. And with liquid hydrogen, it's very hard to keep that sealed. Although they've had plenty of experience with it, 135 space shuttle missions, although some of those leaked and, you know, caused them to delay those missions. They have experience with it. Liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen in the Delta 4 mission, light solar Delta 4s, but the heavy lift and the heaviest lift vehicle that NASA had until this new SLS vehicle. Delta 4, sometimes they put three of them together, four stages together, and that would be the Delta Heavy. Well, they were all liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So they have experience with it, and they're probably, you know, it sounds like they're going to, well, they guess, and when they take it apart, they're going to probably find what they think is a bad seal. And it looks like the seals are probably made of titanium. I know the exhaust hydrogen gas, there was another quick disconnect, that does have a titanium seal to it, and my guess is probably the same type of gasket arrangement for the fill line. So naturally, they're going to have to take this all apart at the launch complex itself, which means building an enclosure for the workers to go in there, because they, you know, not only to protect the workers, you know, from any kind of debris or anything getting near. Near the engine, but they have to purge it with nitrogen. There's going to be some hydrogen in there, and they want to purge it. If you get over a certain percent, you get it to the 8% category, you know, liquid oxygen, you know, and a little spark, you know, you're going to have an ignition, you know, fuel oxygen and a spark is deadly. So they'll have to purge everything and then work on it and probably put it all back together again. But they still won't be able to launch. But they've gone through their window. The window is based on where the moon is located, where the Earth is in its rotation of the Earth when it launches. All the factors are put together so that they launch in daytime, but they also land at daytime. They want to make sure that, you know, on this flight in particular, that the capsule comes down into the Pacific Ocean in daytime. So this window is pretty much shot, and it looks like they're going to probably try in October. They wanted to go earlier in October, but there's a manned flight in October that has to go up to the International Space Station with the crew, and, you know, there's other launches. It's probably, I think, will wind up in the second or third week of October. Also, they can't just leave the rocket there for the next month. They're only allowed 25 days after they leave the vehicle assembly building. 25 days, and then they have to come back. And the reason for that is they have the FTS system, the flight termination system, which is explosives, you know, located inside the vehicle. And those explosives, in case launch, this thing starts right. They could either push a button or computers themselves could have the capability of lighting the charges off to destroy the vehicle. Those things run on batteries, and those batteries have a life of 25 days, and they change out the whole system, the explosives, the batteries every 25 days if they have to. According to the flight rules. But if they maxed out the time, because of that, they're going to bring it back to the vehicle assembly building, and I think, you know, by the time you bring it back and bring it back to the launch complex, you know, the weeks and days start to go by. And this is WSUN. So, I don't know, I thought by tonight that I would be talking about the spacecraft would have been past the moon by now, a week later, and it would have already gone to its retrograde halo orbit, 40,000 miles away from the moon. Yeah, the goal, and then eventually it would have come back. So we'll talk about that in October when we get there. Day-to-day itinerary of the program, and I'm sure you've heard this already. If it's successful, a year and a half from now, they'll put a crew into this vehicle. They've already built the Artemis 2 and most of Artemis 3, and they're working on all the, it's all in stages at different locations. Modules being built in Europe by the European Space Agency. They get shipped here. Well, we've already got there. So anyway, a year and a half from now, they'll be able to launch a crew to the moon. It won't go 40,000 miles behind the moon like this thing. I think it's going to go around 4,000 miles behind the moon, and then eventually come back. And again, land in the Pacific. They'll have a crew of four on that. If that's successful, they check everything out, make sure everything's fine. 1 year later, they plan on actually landing on the moon with another crew of four will go out. It looks like two will stay in the Orion capsule, and two will be going down on a SpaceX vehicle, not even built yet, that will land on the moon. The whole system is always, I don't know, there's always the weakest link, and I think SpaceX, in this case, right now anyway, is the weakest link, but you know, knowing him, he'll probably put a move on, I would guess, pretty quickly, because, you know, he's got, I don't know, over $1 billion contract to develop a vehicle that will actually land on the moon. They call it the Human Landing System, an HLS. And the idea is to launch a Starship, which has never even been launched yet, successfully into orbit. They launch a Starship into orbit with fuel on board. Launch another Starship into orbit with a crew-capable. Have this thing autonomously dock with the fuel vehicle. Fuel to from one to the other, and then from there this thing's supposed to launch to the moon. As far as I know, they've only done some experimenting on the International Space Station with refueling things in space. So I think SpaceX has a long way to go. They launched two starships, one is a fuel tank and one to pick up that fuel after it launches and go to the moon, hang out by the moon and wait for Orion to show up, dock with Orion, have a crew transfer to the Starship. Starship goes down to the moon, two people stay there for 3 days, relaunch, and then redock with the orbiting Orion spacecraft that's still in orbit around the moon, and then from there come back. So, of course, it's, you know, it's the same idea as what went on with Apollo, but Apollo, there's a lot of different shortcuts. Apollo 8 just went to the moon. And when the first time they put a crew on a Saturn V rocket, they launched, you know, went into, and actually went into orbit around the moon. That's where they got themselves into trouble with reading from the book of Genesis on Christmas Eve. Anyway, they eventually came back successfully and landed successfully. They didn't have the LEM with them, the lunar module. That was never even tested yet at the time. But here they're doing it. We have the capability with all modern electronic computers to actually do this autonomously. Launches STS Orion Artemis rocket. It's going to go do everything autonomously, also with help from Mission Control from Houston. Anyway, any questions on Artemis? This is WS2N. Name here is Paul. Okay, and hopefully things get rolling with that. And my goal is to eventually have a space station in orbit around the moon, and eventually have a ham radio system, and that's already planned by the ARRL and HAMSAT. They've already got plans on eventually having a ham station on that gateway space station, which will be, you know, permanently in lunar orbit. It's after Artemis 4, Artemis 3, by the time they get to Artemis 4, the next crew that will land on the moon will do it differently. They'll actually fly out to the to lunar orbit, dock with the Gateway Space Station. Attached to the Gateway Space Station will be, again, the human landing system by SpaceX, and you'll be able to do it that way. That will go down to the moon, come back, dock with Gateway, and then from there you go from Gateway to Orion and back home. And hopefully by then, I really don't like the idea of having one contractor involved with the lunar landing system. SpaceX, they had plans of actually having three, Dianetics, and also Blue Origin. For some reason, they have to do with money. They said, let's only pick one. NASA's rules, they usually follow redundancy, you know, two or three different ways to get around a problem. You know, I'd like to see two different human landing systems attached to the Gateway space station. And, you know, if you have somebody go down to the moon, and, you know, they're supposed to come up in a week or so, and they can't do it for some reason, you can send the other spacecraft down and act as a rescue vehicle. Right now, you wouldn't be able to do that. SpaceX could say, we'll have two human launching systems, landing systems attached to the Gateway. Well, I don't want to go down and rescue another group with the same vehicle that had a problem. You know, use a completely different vehicle from another company, which I'm in favor of doing that. But nobody's talking about that. Any comments? Okay, another mission I'm following, September 11th. I know it's a big day because of what went on September 11th, but this company called Firefly, that's another new rocket company, that launched a rocket last year from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and it got off the ground. I mean, you know, most brand new rockets usually scrub the first day, maybe two or three times. This one actually got off the launch pad right off the bat, and it looked like it was going to make it to orbit. And but by the time it was time to separate from the first stage to the second stage, it had problems, and then flight termination system took effect, and they blew it up. It started to go haywire. Apparently, they had problems with one of the engines that they have, and that's a liquid kerosene fuel with a liquid oxygen. So they're going to try again, but I'm not sure what's going to happen. They have all kinds of problems with leaders of that company. One guy quit, another guy hired another guy, and I think he's going to resign. I think another fella. So I don't know, strange goings on with the Firefly. About 4 or 5 years ago, they claimed bankruptcy, and this other guy from the Ukraine came back with a bunch of money and resurrected it. But now they seem to put their act together. And they plan on building another engine for Northrop Grumman for the entire region rocket. So, you know, they do have a big influx of money. They're also building a lander, a lunar lander called the Ghost. So, they have plans on landing on the moon a few years from now.
Completely.
They'll land there. And they're not going to land on the South Pole. They're going to land there roughly in the equator. Look at the moon. Far right hand side, there's a crater there that they plan on landing right near called Mare Crescent. Far right, just up a little bit from the equator. We'll see if that lander makes it. Now, of course, this one doesn't have people. These are all research vehicles. So, we'll see how they do. Hope they get off the ground. I just want to talk about Moxie. Moxie is doing very good. There was a report on that. Moxie is the one gadget that's, I don't know, about 10 inches by 10 inches by 12 inches. Roughly a box-shaped piece of equipment that was put on the Perseverance rover and launched to Mars about a year and a half ago. It landed on February 18th, a year and a half ago. And the idea is to manufacture oxygen on Mars, see if it could take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Most of Mars is carbon dioxide. Separate the two and wind up with oxygen. And the report that came back just recently is they've done it at least 7 times already with this unit. They've successfully collected oxygen, and they say they around 8 to 10 grams every time they do it. And they could do that within an hour. And then, of course, they shut it down and wait for another day for another test. So it's based on that system that's working so good. If you sent up, full size, a couple thousand pound machine, you might be able to make a whole bunch of oxygen for breathing, and a lot more machines to actually make liquid oxygen for a return trip back for future landers. But Moxie's working. It stands for Mars Oxygen Institute Resource Utilization Experiment, Moxie. And it uses up its power. You know, the rover doesn't have power for experience from a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. That thing puts out, I think, around 109 kilowatts per hour. So, 109 watts per hour. So, kilowatt every hour. So, but this thing uses only 300 watts of power. And now, at night, this thing is charging. It's charging up its batteries. First grid has plenty of power on board. The staff, this thing is only using 300 watts. It's a 30-pound unit. And, we'll see how it does. They do say it produces about 10 grams of oxygen per hour. And then the article I was reading said one person would be, one astronaut, if they were to breathe this stuff, it would be enough oxygen for that person to breathe for 20 minutes. So 10 grams, it seems like 10 grams of what, is like nothing, as far as I'm concerned. And that's why we only have a question. Roy, what do you think? 10 grams of oxygen. Do you really think that could supply enough oxygen for me to breathe for 20 minutes? Do you think? I don't know about that statement. I'm sure it's liquid oxygen that they're talking about, because gas is warm. But I don't see that happening. Anyway, you know what I mean? Roy, AC2GSWS2N.
Yeah, Paul, they're kind of fudging the numbers. What they're kind of giving you is if you could just use all the oxygen, theoretically, if you just sat very quietly and you don't burn any further calories doing any physical labors, which is kind of difficult, that's the amount of time. But that's sort of nonsense, because what's going on is sort of like getting 100% of power out of a battery. We are used to breathing an atmosphere that's 20% oxygen. Now, over time, it's 18% oxygen doesn't work so well on low fuel. So you'll have oxygen left at the point that your body uses the function correctly and you pass away. They're fudging numbers, unfortunately.
Yeah, I kind of thought that. That's why I thought that. I was trying to look up on the internet how much is the average person breathe. Well, you go down. I could be at that for hours. I guess eventually I get the answer. But I just thought it sounded a little like they were stretching the numbers. But it is working, so you would just need a lot of moxies up there. Perseverance weighs 2,000 pounds on Earth. One third of that weight on Mars. So I guess if you set, maybe half a dozen, the equivalent of a half a dozen Perseverance rovers up there, using this system, I'm sure that would work. Wow. Your last transmission was a little breaking up. Am I breaking up at all, Roy?
Well, there's a little background noise. I wouldn't call it breaking up.
Now, that time you were 100%. But, I got every word last time, but it was like, scratches, were in there. No, now it's back to normal. Maybe something on your key when you keyed up.
I don't know. I'm using the same thing. I just think that the link is a little waffly. Are you listening through Glen Oaks, or are you listening through Sheldon?
Glen Oaks. I prefer Glen Oaks. Last week I got a report that I was breaking up a little bit. I had to go to high power. And so I turned the antenna around, and I left it on at Glen Oaks. But then when I went to check in for the, the NostalgiaNet. By the way, the NostalgiaNet was great. It was all about dentistry. You would have loved this one, though, Roy. Anyway, anytime I tried to key up, they really wouldn't hear me. I was competing, Glen Oaks was more or less, taking out Selden. once I gave up with that, I just, you know, went back to, you know, pointing my antenna west again for Glen Oaks.